I invite you to join me in 1 Samuel 14. Open your Old Testaments to 1 Samuel 14. If you want to go into battle, I think we would all agree, even if we're not military experts like I'm not, that numbers are pretty important in terms of how many soldiers you have compared to how many soldiers the other guy has. And in fact, if you remember Jesus talking in Luke chapter 14 about the cost of being his disciple, he talked about the need for numbers of soldiers. He said, if you go against somebody with 20,000 and you've got 10,000, then you better think really hard about that before you try to attack that person. And so in terms of military strategy, we understand the amount of people on your side is extremely important to think about. But in terms of the spiritual battle that all of us are in on a daily basis with the devil and his forces, on the battlefield that we fight, we know that numbers are not important in the least, because we have the King of all kings fighting at our back, at our side, at our front. And that it doesn't matter how many people he has, how many angels at his disposal, when he is fighting, no one can stand against him and fight against him. And so ultimately, we know that Jesus was one person, and yet he, by himself, saved the entire world from sin. And so what we're going to learn about today in one particular story that kind of gets overlooked about Jonathan and what he did one day with his armor bearer, we're going to be reminded of the fact that the Lord can save by many, or he can save by few. And what we're going to be remembering today is the fact that he saved by one. So let's read this together and be reminded of this wonderful story. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron. And the people who were with him were about 600 men, including Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side and a rocky crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other Sina. The one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south in front of Geba. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." And his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you heart and soul." Love that. Then Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men and we will show ourselves to them. And if they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place and we will not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand. And this shall be the sign to us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us and we will show you a thing." And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed them after him. And that first strike, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, killed about 20 men, within, as it were, half a furrow's length in an acre of land. And there was panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. And the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. And Saul said to the people who were with him, "Count and see who's gone from us." And when they had counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. Now, while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle. And behold, every Philistine sword was against his fellow, and there was a very great confusion. Now the Hebrews, who had been with the Philistines before that time, and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth-Aven. What I'd like to do with all of this is draw out several points about what we see in this wonderful story, about what is happening here with Jonathan and his guy, and then the aftermath of them deciding to go into battle in a really unorthodox, ill-advised, not something you should try at home kind of way. And what God did with that, and then several things that we learned from this before we take the supper and think about the one man, the God-man who saved us all. So let's think about what's going on in the text. So verses 1 through 5, as this story begins, we see this really unusual situation happening and unfolding here. Saul and his army of about 600 guys are just sitting in the camp, and the king's son decides, with his personal companion who takes care of him and keeps his armor bright and shiny and alongside of him, they decide to just slip away. Now, as we come into this chapter, something I need to explain about the context. When you back up one chapter and you just glance over what's happening in 1 Samuel 13 before we get to chapter 14, the Israelites are not really in a great spot, especially King Saul. Because in chapter 13, King Saul has been told, "Your kingdom is not going to last because you really blew it here." So they have been engaged in battle against the Philistines there too, and Saul was supposed to wait for Samuel to come so that Samuel can offer the sacrifice, and then they go into battle, and Samuel just doesn't come when Saul thinks that he should come. And so Saul notices the people scattering away from him. He decides to offer that sacrifice himself, and wouldn't you know it, about that time Samuel shows up and says, "What have you done? You know you weren't supposed to do that." And so as a result of that disobedience, not to me, but to the God behind me, you are now no longer going to be king long term. Somebody else has been selected who has a heart that God is looking for, because it sure isn't yours. You don't care about God the way that the next king will. And so Saul, just from that point on, just sort of fades more and more and more into the background of the stories that happen in 1 Samuel. And he spends most of the time after David gets picked out trying to chase him around, trying to spear him and kill him. And so this is what happens here in the next chapter, is he's not doing much. Why did the Israelites want kings to begin with? Well, we want somebody to go out and fight our battles for us. Yeah, how's that working out? He's not doing that. He's sitting in his tent drinking coffee or whatever he was doing. Meanwhile, his son, Jonathan, says, "You know what? there's a garrison over there, and I think I'm going to go over and do something about that. By himself, with one other person beside him. And did you notice how the text makes a big deal about the fact that nobody knew about this? So verse 1 explicitly says his dad didn't know anything about this. And then if you look at the end of verse 3, it explicitly says none of the people knew anything about this either. Now, I don't know why he didn't tell people. Maybe he didn't want his dad to worry. Maybe he was concerned that his dad would put his foot down about this plan. There's any number of possibilities there. But he just didn't tell anybody. And he just went out and did this. He's not going to toot his own horn. He's not going to brag about his mission. He just quietly exits. Meanwhile, the Israelites just sit there and do nothing. And look at what God does with it. This is just, isn't this just the best story? God takes these two people against this whole garrison, and he blesses this attack abundantly. I think it's interesting that when Jonathan and his guy get to this camp, they're not exactly sure what's going to happen. Notice the conversation between the two of them. Jonathan says, "It may be that the Lord will bless us," but he doesn't have any guarantees about that. It's not like a prophet came up to Jonathan and said, "Now, at 2 o'clock p.m. tomorrow, you're going to be very successful in battle, you and your armor bearer." Nobody told him to do this. He just does it and says, we should just try this. He is positive, though. Look what he is positive about. Look what he knows for sure, even though he's not sure what's going to happen to him. He knows definitely that the Lord can save by few or by many. That is locked into his brain, which then causes him to do that. That's a wonderful attitude that Jonathan's father just did not have. In fact, if you back up again to the last chapter in chapter 13, you'll notice that Saul is kind of obsessed with numbers and with trying to find out exactly how much of an army do I have. In fact, if you look back at chapter 13, verse 11, that's the reason that he gives to Samuel for why I just had to offer that sacrifice, because I was looking out at my army and I was counting heads, and I noticed that heads were running for the hills. And that worried me, because I need my army. I need a big force of people, or I'm just not going to be successful. Baloney. His son got that, but he didn't. Chapter 13, verse 15, notice what happens there. Samuel arose, went from Gilgal. Rest of the people went up after Saul to meet the army. Look at the end of that verse says, "And Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men." And then in our story here, chapter 14, what does Saul do? When he first says, "Oh, there's a big tumult happening over there," what is his immediate reaction to that? It's not to go, "Okay, guys, let's get everybody together and send out the cavalry." No, his first reaction is to go, "Okay, we need to count up and see who's still here and who has left. Why does that even matter? Just get out there and join the battle already." But he doesn't do that, because he's obsessed with numbers. Gotta count. Remember, that was later on one of David's greatest sins, other than Bathsheba. And so he got in trouble with that. The Lord doesn't care about numbers, and neither should his people. But look what happens with Jonathan, because he's not concerned about numbers. So the first strike in verse 14 is mentioned there. They kill about 20 guys. And even the amount of land where they were fighting is mentioned to us. Did you notice what it says there? Half a furrow's length of an acre. That is a small enough field to be plowed by a yoke of oxen for half a day's work. So I don't know exactly the dimensions of that, but the point is, it's a small-ish area in which they were duking it out and being successful and throwing the entire camp of the Philistines in an uproar. And so what happens in the last third of the story, from 16 through 23, those verses there, Saul finally gets wind of this. He is very confused and uncertain about what to do. How do we handle this? He finally joins the fight, and then that just produces this wonderful chain reaction. But at first, notice that the Israelite camp is not exactly sure what's going on. So he finally figures out, okay, it's embarrassingly enough, it's my son who's missing and his armor bearer. And so what should we do? Well, okay, let's get the Ark of God over here. And so that implies that they want to inquire of God, they want to ask questions about God. But then he has second thoughts about that, and he tells the priest, no, actually, withdraw your hand. We're not going to do that, and we're going to go into battle finally anyway. And so you see this chain reaction starting with these groups. Did you notice verse 21? In verse 21, it sounds like there were Israelites who were on the side of the Philistines, who had gone with them into their camp and were doing, serving them or doing whatever they were doing with them. But verse 21 says they started to pick up weapons and rebel. And then verse 22, you had Israelites who weren't even in the area, but they got wind of it. And so they traveled over from Ephraim to this spot and participated in the battle as well. And all of this happened because one man talked to his one other guy and decided to go up and fight. And you notice the conclusion of this story? What does it focus on? Who is the main character of this story? It's not Jonathan. It's not his armor bearer. It's not Saul. Not anybody else. Look at what verse 23 says. The Lord saved Israel. And that is absolutely on the mind of Jonathan too, because when he is talking to his armor bearer, he's talking about Israel. What God needs to save Israel, not just us. And this is a direct quote from Exodus 14. Do you remember right after the crossing of the Red Sea, when Israel is finally safe on the other side, Pharaoh and his soldiers are drowned? That's what the text says back there too, that the Lord saved Israel that day. It's the same exact phrase. And so God can use anybody to accomplish his will as he used these people. And there's a lot to learn from this text. So I want to pull out three key ideas that I think we should think about. And the first one is this: that taking action for the Lord should not and does not depend on receiving public orders, a general mobilization. Okay, here is what we're all going to do. You don't need that to serve God. You can decide yourself to get up and do something for him. Think about how Jonathan could have been justified in sitting in the camp and doing nothing. Well, after all, I mean, I'm not the king. It's the king's job to tell all of the troops to get together, and we're going to go attack there. And so I've got to wait for my orders. I don't want to be presumptuous. I don't want to just take things into my own hands. I mean, he is the Lord's anointed. Let him be the one to sound the bugle and tell us all what to do. And you know what? Since everybody else is just sitting around, then there's not much I can do personally about this. I'm just one person. Yeah, you are just one person who happens to be serving the Almighty, one powerful God. And he can do everything. Think about how that applies with us. You know, when we look at this congregation, we're always going to see areas where we can grow as a group. And if we're not careful, laziness can set in, and we can look around and just say, well, I don't really see many other people doing anything in this area of our spiritual lives as a group, so there's not really much I can do personally about that. I'm just going to wait until one of the elders gets up and says, we're all moving in this direction now. That could be a choice that you could make. But since we're never going to be a perfect church of God's people because we are sinners, all of us are, trying to grow into holy lives the Lord has for us to grow into. There's always going to be work to do that you can do and that I can do for the Lord. And so we have a choice about our reaction to those holes. Are we going to sit around and criticize other people and do nothing? Or are we actually going to work and not wait for public announcements to do what God wants us to do? Think about sheep. What do sheep do? They have a shepherd who takes care of them, makes sure that they're in a good environment to live. But does the shepherd have to go to each individual sheep and go, okay, you need to eat some grass, there's water, you need to drink that water, you need to lie down and get some sleep? No. The sheep does those things because it's a sheep and it's going to eat and it's going to drink. All the shepherd does is make sure that that sheep is protected and that wolves don't come around and eat that sheep up. That is the role of our local shepherds. That is the role ultimately of the shepherd of our souls, King Jesus. He wants us to work. He doesn't have to micromanage our lives. He wants us to be crying out to Him for support and for strength and for help. But He wants us to get out into the vineyard and do what He wants us to do. I'll make this specific application. Some of you, and I've been encouraged by this, some of you have been asking about, what are family groups going to do in the next year, 2023? I'm working on that. You will hear some public things being said about that in the near future, God willing. But you know what? There's nothing stopping any of us from taking other Christians here and taking them into our homes and showing hospitality to each other, regardless of what the public congregational plan is for hospitality. That's something all of you can do. And me too. I'm including me in that. But I'm trying to put that on all of our plates. Please do not just wait around for what the congregation is going to do before you do something productive for God and His people. Please think about that. Something else that we can point out from this is that enthusiastic partners are extremely important for the work of God. This chapter could have gone very differently. Jonathan could have just decided, I'm not going to go. But also, think about his armor bearer. His armor bearer could have had a couple of different reactions to what Jonathan wanted to do. In fact, I have to be honest about this. If I were the armor bearer, I would probably have had a resistant reaction to what he's saying. I would probably say, okay, now let's be reasonable about this. Jonathan, I really appreciate your zeal there, but let's talk to some other people. Let's try to get a bigger group together besides just you and me. And let's form a plan and let's pray about it and let's think about it. And maybe in a month we will get something together on that. But just kind of hold that thought and cool down a little bit. He didn't have that kind of reaction of, oh, are you crazy? You want to do that now? He also was not passive in his reaction. He could have said, well, I mean, dude, you can go and do that. But I'm not doing that because I know that that's certain death. He didn't say that either. Instead, look at what he did say. And I love this man. I don't know what his name was. We don't know anything else about him in the scriptures. But what he said in that moment was absolutely perfect. He said, you go do that. And I'm going to be right there with you because I am with you heart and soul. Isn't that beautiful language? I just love this guy's heart. And so true to his word, he climbs up into this crag with Jonathan. He starts attacking these people. Do you remember what Jesus did when he sent out his disciples to do. He put some training wheels on them before he sends them out to the Gentiles, to the nations. You remember that he sends them out in pairs, two by two, because it's really good to have somebody beside you when you're doing a work that is uncomfortable, that you're not familiar with. Ecclesiastes talks about this too. Ecclesiastes 4, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. God designed us for unity, not just with him, but for each other. We need companions alongside of us who are not going to say, well, I don't think that's going to work. I don't know if I want to be a part of that. I mean, you go ahead and do that. And if it looks like you're doing well, maybe I'll come alongside of you and help you later on down the road. But not right now. We need people like this armor bearer who say, I'm going to stand beside you in this fight as it starts, not after it's over. Which is essentially when the rest of the Israelites come into the battle, is after it's already been established that the Lord is working something great here. Are you that kind of person for your brothers and sisters? Are you like this armor bearer in the way that you stand beside other people who care about Jesus? Something to think about. And the third really encouraging thing that I find from this text is that our excitement for God's work can ignite a chain reaction of workers. And so again, this text begins with one man attacking. It ends with an army behind him. Verse 21, again, people who are on the side of the enemy, they come and they fight with the Lord's people. Verse 22, people who are scared to death hiding in the holes, as the Philistines said, they come out of the holes and they join the fight. When you decide that you're going to do what needs to be done by the strength of God, not by your own strength, you watch and see what happens. And it's been true so many times in my life as I have looked around at other disciples. Sometimes some of the people that you might least expect to come and join you in what you're doing, they come and join you in what you're doing. And they fight alongside of you. God can change a culture through just one person or two. And it doesn't matter what we're talking about, whether we're talking about a whole congregation of people or you're talking about a family. So many of you, and we've talked about this recently, so many of you are in physical families with maybe children or siblings or parents who do not serve the Lord. Your family can be changed if you alone serve the Lord the way that you're supposed to. And I say the word can for a reason here, and Jonathan was careful about that too. The Lord, we don't know how the Lord's going to use us here, but regardless of whether we're able to see our impact or not, this is who our God is. He uses zealous servants to accomplish His work. We've got to be those zealous servants. Philippians chapter 1, verse 14, Paul said this, and most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Evidently, in the church at Rome, and Paul's probably in prison in Rome when he writes Philippians, evidently there wasn't a lot of teaching and evangelism going on in that congregation. But because of what Paul went through in his jail time there in that city and how he used it and how he was not afraid to keep spreading the word, other Christians saw that happening and decided we're going to do that too out of jail in our current situations in life. Most of them increased their faith. That's encouraging. And that is exactly what is going on here in 1 Samuel 14 with this story. So think about the different approach that Jonathan could have taken. Well, I'm just going to mope around and I'm going to talk about how my father has poor leadership skills and how he ought to be reading some leadership books and taking some classes and improving himself and going out and fighting battles like he should. He didn't do any of that. Yeah, there was poor leadership by his father. So what? He can still do something. He can still go work. We need to follow his example. Please do not be someone who sits back in a pew and says, I really think the congregation ought to be doing more of such and such. I think the congregation ought to be more connected and vibrant. Yeah, okay. What are you doing to help the congregation be more connected and vibrant? And I'm going to say this, and I hope you know, I mean this with love. Do we even see you here at these assemblies that we have? Or do we only see you during this little Lord's Supper hour once a week? If you want to see this congregation change, where are you? Where are you? We need your help. There's work to do. There is so much good work to do. We need armor bearers. We need Jonathans to be standing beside us. And so if we need to be more hospitable, please take the charge in that and take Christians and other strangers into your own home and show that. If you want to be more connected to other people, then we need you here. Not just in the assembly, but yes, it includes the assembly to stand beside us. If we are not putting our hands to the plow, what right do we have to criticize other Christians for not doing that? That's called hypocrisy. And God forbid we do that. If you feel passionately something ought to change here, lead the charge. Great. We need help with doing that. So think about that in your life. We're going to go to the Lord's Supper now, but I want to take you back to this wonderful phrase that is here in verse 6. When he says to his man before they go and attack, nothing can hinder the Lord's. Nothing can stop him from saving by many or by few. God only needs one person to do the right thing in order to accomplish what he wants to do with a church and with the world. And so think about what happens only 3 chapters later in the book of 1 Samuel. You read about a much more well-known story of another young man who goes and fights the Philistines by himself, who crosses a field running to meet a giant who has been taunting the armies of the living God. And that person says, who is he that he thinks he can do that? I'm going to go over there and kill him. Cut off his head. And he did. While all of the other Israelites, Saul included, were sitting back watching it happen. Jonathan took one look at that young man. And he said, that's someone who gets it. That's someone that I'm going to love and attach myself to. Because he does the exact same thing in his life that I'm trying to do. And then about 1,000 years later, there was a descendant of David who did the very same thing that David did. Jesus single-handedly ran across the spiritual battlefield to the Goliath of all Goliaths, Satan himself, and defeated him in combat. Not in a combat that looked anything like Roman armies sweeping across the battlefield and Jews opposing them, but it looked like the cross. He went into death. He fought the one who held the keys to death, and he disarmed him. And he sealed his fate as one who will be thrown into the lake of fire with all those who serve him. That is the Lord we remember today. The son of David, who did the same kind of thing that David did himself. I thought about a passage in Isaiah 59 as I was thinking about this passage in 1 Samuel. And I want to read it here. Isaiah 59 says, "He saw that there was no man, and wondered that there was no one to intercede. Then his own arm brought him salvation, and his righteousness upheld him. He put on righteousness as a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on garments of vengeance for clothing, and wrapped himself in zeal as a cloak." You know, when Paul writes about the armor of God in Ephesians 6, you know where he gets that language from? He gets that from the prophet Isaiah. Because that prophet describes what God covers himself with when he goes to battle and there's no one who can oppose him. No one has ever been successful in that. Because the Lord can save by many or by few. And when he saved us, he did it himself. Let's think about that as we take the Lord's Supper together.